Welcome to Wall Street Unspun with your host, Peter Schiff.
But it's a giant bubble in search of a pin, and it's going
to
find one.
Are you confused with the ups and downs of the economy and what it means to you?
Don't believe the propaganda, and that's what it is. When you're listening to an analyst on a lot of these popular financial shows, you're not getting investment advice. You're getting propaganda.
Get ready to untangle the web of misinformation provided by the mainstream media.
These firms are trying to sell you stocks. Their real clients, their banking clients, are trying to get rid of stuff.
And now, here's your host of Wall Street Unspun, the president of Euro Pacific Capital and a licensed broker with a passion for truth. It's Wall Street Unspun with Peter Schiff.
Hi, everybody. Welcome again to another live episode of Wall Street Unspun. This is Peter Schiff. I am broadcasting live from Connecticut, 8 p.m. Eastern Time, 5 p.m. Pacific Time, on my website, www.europac.net, and also on shortwave radio, 5.07 megahertz. And this is April 1st, April Fool's Day, 2009, and I guess we've got a big assembly of fools, 20 of them over at the G20, discussing how to resolve the global economic crisis. And of course, you know, you've got two opposing camps. You've got the nations that want to keep on borrowing and spending, and you've got the rest of the world who's financing the party. And I guess the big borrowers and spenders are the United States, of course, the king borrower, and its jester, the British. And we're there basically beating the drums for more deficits, more money printing, more consumption. And other countries are trying to resist. You know, it's interesting that the Europeans are trying to preach restraint and capitalism to the Americans. And we're over there in Europe out-Europeaning the Europeans, out-Frenching the French. We're the ones that want to print money. We're the ones that want to run up the deficits. And we're being lectured by the Europeans that inflation is not a panacea. And, of course, then you've also got the large creditor nations, the biggest creditors like China, not only who are objecting to the whole thing, but are talking about an alternative to the dollar as the world's reserve currency. Because, you know, China is the biggest patsy in this whole deal, because China owns over $1 trillion of our debt. And, of course, they buy about 50% of all the new borrowing the government has. They finance half of it. And we're proposing a $2 trillion deficit this year and $1 trillion deficits into the future as far as the eye can see, which means China is penciled in to fund half of it at least. I don't think that's a prospect that they are looking forward to. I mean, if the Chinese are worried now about the $1 trillion they already have, think about the problem if they have $2 trillion or $3 trillion or $5 trillion. You don't think the Chinese can see this? This is really a key decision for the Chinese. You know, everybody's always said, oh, you know, the Chinese, they own so much debt, they can't afford, they have to keep buying. They've got $1 trillion. They have no choice. Well, you know what? We're giving them a choice. If we were just asking them to borrow a little bit more, maybe you can make that good money after bad argument. But if we're asking them to double up or triple up or quadruple up, now they've got a real decision to make. Because now taking a loss on $1 trillion, even if it's a big loss, doesn't look that bad compared to having to take a loss on $5 trillion. My gosh. You know, so, and of course, the Chinese are proposing these solutions where maybe we move off of the dollar-based reserve system and we move to a system based on SDRs, but that's not going to fly. The U.S. isn't going to go for that. So if China wants to move away from the dollar, it doesn't need anybody's permission. It just does it. It just does it on its own. They don't have to hold our dollars. No one's putting a gun to their head. You know, they could sell. Sure, they take a loss, but at least they can get out of this hole. They can buy more euros. They can buy more yen. They can buy more gold, which is what they should be doing. I mean, I don't want to really see the world go from a fiat-based backed system to backing currencies with some SDRs, which aren't even a real currency, that are backed by other currencies that are backed by nothing. We need to back our currencies by money. We need to back them by gold. Again, remember, the only reason the dollar became the world's reserve currency is because not only was the dollar backed by gold, but it was redeemable. into gold on demand. And if it wasn't for that characteristic, we never would have got the world to agree to make it the reserve currency in the first place. And of course, once we conned them into accepting our dollars, we promptly defaulted on our promise and declared bankruptcy, basically, under Nixon. But we really, the full consequences of that action are now finally being felt. I don't think there's going to be anything officially proclamated from this group of 20, whatever. They're probably going to come out with smiley faces and, you know, everything is great. We're all going to work together. But behind the scenes, I think there's a real rift there. And John Brown touched on it on his commentary today, which you can read on the website at www.europac.net on the right-hand side of our website. But these are usually photo ops and joint press conferences. But I do believe behind the surface, behind the scenes, there's some real rifts that you're not going to read about or see about in the news. And I think this is really going to be a seismic event. And, you know, as I've said, you know, the world, you know, really needs to stop lending us money. You know, Barack Obama's there, you know, begging for money. The world should say, no mas, or, you know, no, we're not going to lend you any more money. You know, I don't believe in bailouts, right? I don't believe the U.S. government should be bailing out anybody. They shouldn't have bailed out any of the financials. They shouldn't be contemplating bailing out or have bailed out the autos. I don't believe in bailouts. I also don't believe that the world should bail out the U.S. government. And that's what they're doing. And the problem is, when they bail out the U.S. government, they take that money and they bail everybody else out. They recycle the bailout money. But the problem is, the government is doing harm with that money. Our foreign creditors are growing our government like a cancer. If it wasn't for the world funding our debt, the U.S. government would be too broke to bail anybody out. They'd have to do the right thing. They'd have to let these companies fail. They'd have no choice. And that's exactly what this economy needs. Now, if foreigners want to invest in America, I got no problem with that. I welcome foreign direct investment. If the Chinese want to build a factory over here, more power to them. Build it. But don't loan money to our government. They're just going to use it to destroy the economy. They're going to use it to strangle our productivity. They're going to get bigger, and which means our economy is going to get smaller. And they're going to give it to Americans so they can blow the money on consumption. Don't lend money to our government. Lend it to private entrepreneurs who want to start businesses so they can produce products and employ Americans. That's where foreign money should go, to the private sector. And it shouldn't come from the government. I don't like government aid. One government gives money to another government. I want individuals, private individuals, to invest and to loan money to other private individuals. And I want the motive to be a profit. I don't want it to be political back scratching. I want people to be incentivized by a profit. And there's nothing wrong with that. That is Adam Smith. That is the invisible hand. And it knows no borders. But if we're gonna get foreign citizens to invest their hard-earned savings and loan it to American entrepreneurs to build the factories of the future in this country, we better build a competitive economy, which means we better shrink our government. We better cut regulation. We better reduce taxes. You know, we've got to be a competitive place for people to invest. We don't want to just have money being funneled from one government to another. And, of course, it's crazy when the U.S. government gives aid to other governments, because not only do we corrupt those other countries, but we don't even have the money. If we want to give aid, if the United States has a foreign aid program, we're just recycling China's foreign aid. How can the U.S. can't give money to any country without first borrowing it from China or borrowing it from Japan or Saudi Arabia? The whole thing is a sham, and it has to end. And we'll see if we make any progress at this at the G7. And, you know, talking about how crazy things are, and look what's going on again with the automobile companies. Now you have Barack Obama actually saying it looks like maybe the best option for General Motors is bankruptcy. You know, duh, that is the best option. But you know what? I don't even think Barack Obama means it. I don't think he's going to let him go bankrupt. We'll see. I just think he's trying to talk tough. But in the end, I think he's going to cave. But in the meantime, if we do let him go bankrupt, what about the billions we've already given him? Well, that's money down the toilet then, isn't it? Wouldn't it have been better to let him go bankrupt sooner before we flush that money? But of course, look at what the government is doing. It shows you how clueless they are about the problems. They just passed a stimulus, a tax stimulus to encourage people to buy cars this year. In order to get the tax break, you got to buy your car before the end of the year. And what it is the government's going to let you give you a deduction for your sales tax or any excise taxes. But the idea is they want Americans to go out and buy new cars. Now, what kind of stupid plan is that? Here we are, a nation loaded up with debt. Americans are in debt. They can't barely afford to make their mortgage payments. That's why we have all these toxic assets, right? Why are the assets toxic? Because the Americans can't pay back the money they borrowed. That's what makes them toxic. So we Americans can't afford their mortgages. They can't afford their credit card debt. They got student loans they can't afford. And what does the government want us to do? Take on even more debt and buy new cars. Are these guys mad? Don't they think we have cars? What do they think are clogging up all the highways? I can't go anywhere without traffic. We got plenty of cars. What makes them think that the solution to the problem is buy more cars? Yet that's what they're doing. This is insane. And you know, thinking about this insanity, what else did the government do? They're contemplating another stimulus for car buyers where they want to give you a tax incentive. They haven't passed this one yet. They're talking about it. They want to give you a tax incentive to trade in your fuel-efficient SUV or pickup and buy a fuel-efficient car. Now, think about this for a second. First of all, one of the reasons that Americans bought so many gas-guzzling SUVs, and I know I bought one myself, is because the government gave a big tax credit to small businesses who bought SUVs. They said if you buy a car that weighs over 6,000 pounds, which pretty much had to be an SUV, you can write off, depreciate the entire purchase in the first year. That's a huge tax benefit, huge incentive to buy an SUV. It was so big that it made me buy one. Now, so here you have the government put these crazy tax incentives to get people to buy fuel-efficient cars that they otherwise wouldn't have bought. Now, they're trying to put in another tax incentive to get us to trade those cars in that many people wouldn't have even bought without the initial incentive. But also think about this. GM is in trouble. One of the reasons they're in trouble is because they leased a lot of SUVs to people, and now the leases are coming up, and they're getting those SUVs back, and the trade-in value is lousy. Also, a lot of people who bought SUVs that didn't lease them aren't making their payments, and so they're repossessing them. And so you've got a glut of these SUVs on the market already. Now, if the government is trying to incentivize people into trading in yet more SUVs, that's going to further suppress the resale value and market of the SUVs and compound the problems for companies like General Motors. And, of course, if we're going to trade in our gas-guzzling U.S. cars to buy fuel-efficient cars, where are those cars going to be manufactured? Japan? So we're going to the incentive is trade in your American car. We'll give you a tax break to buy a foreign car. And that's going to jack up our trade deficit even more. I mean, these guys are completely clueless with everything that they're doing when it comes to the automobile sector or understanding the nature of this problem and what the solution is. To think that an indebted nation needs to go deeper into debt to buy more stuff, more things. You know, I mean, hopefully the G7 leaders will talk some sense. You know, I actually heard Barack Obama today in a clip on the news, and I see a lot of sound bites from this guy, and they make sense. He says some good stuff, but then, of course, he undoes it all with his actions and other stuff. And he said to the G7 that the world is going to have to get used to an America that consumes less, that spends less, and saves more. Exactly. Exactly. But then why are his policies in opposition to that? And then, of course, what he said when he described the fact that America was going to consume less, he basically challenged the rest of the world, saying the world's going to have to do more, that America can't be the sole engine of the global economy, that the rest of the world has to pick up the slack. Now, what does he mean? Pick up the slack by spending? By consuming? See, he still doesn't understand. He still doesn't get it. We're not the engine. We're the caboose. The engine is the production. The engine is the savings. The world wasn't growing because Americans were spending. America was spending because the world was growing. And the world was loaning us their productivity. They were allowing us to eat the fruits of their labor. What Barack Obama is saying is, you can reclaim those fruits for yourself and enjoy the meal. while Americans are going to have to go hungry. That's what he's really saying, but he doesn't understand it. Anyway, let me jump to the phones. Got Jeff calling from California. How are you, Jeff?
Hey, Peter. How you doing?
Good.
I have two quick questions for you. The first one, I have a friend who's Venezuelan who moved here a few years ago, and he still has a lot of friends there. And he told me the other day that out of about 700 of the smaller mom-and-pop gold mines, and I don't know how big he defines a mom-and-pop gold mine, he said only six are still owned by Venezuelans. The rest have been pretty much forcibly sold off to the Chinese at the behest of Chavez. What do you think that means for future gold prices? Is China planning a gold-backed currency? I know you've talked about that before.
Well, look, if China, the Chinese are smart, and they know that gold is money, and that China is, it could be the world's biggest gold producer now. They might have passed South Africa. So they're producing more gold domestically. They're buying more gold. They're in talks to buy more mining companies out in Australia. So they're obviously expanding in this area. I think they should buy more gold stocks. You know, while we're talking about gold stocks, the Huey Index, the HUI, which is the Philadelphia, you know, Gold Bugs Index, broke out and closed at a new high today for this move. And I think, you know, maybe that's a positive divergence. Maybe that's a leading indicator of a new upward move coming in the price of gold, because we've seen a lot of strength in the gold stocks, which could be a leading indicator, because now the stocks are actually trading better than the metal. And that wasn't the case. For a long time, we've seen a divergence the other way, where gold stocks have kind of shrugged off the strength in the metal. Now we're seeing the gold stocks outperforming the metal, and maybe this is going to lead the entire complex higher.
The second question I had is, I'm a web developer by trade, and of course I've been to europac.net, and it's a great resource for information, but you know, it's getting a bit dated, and I'm sure you know it could use like a bit of a makeover and some few programming improvements to make some of the articles a little easier to find, the videos. If you want to, if somebody tells me to go look at a video from you talking about housing prices in like 2006, it's pretty tough to find it on there. I have to go back through the archives and hunt for it. Are you guys planning any upgrades to the website?
I don't know. We're always working on it. If you have any suggestions or ideas, or you think that you can help in any way, you know, why not drop us an email, and maybe we can have someone get back to you for if you have any advice on how to, you know, make it more searchable or more friendly.
Oh, yeah, sure. I'd love to do that. I'll send you a ping after the show. One more point. I read in a feed today the story from Bloomberg by Craig Torres, and the title was, where is it? The Internal Reserve Memo Suggests a Gradual Return to the Gold Standard. The article was updated a couple hours after it was posted, so I cannot confirm that it was actually on Bloomberg. Like I said, I just saw a feed of the article on somebody else's website.
Yeah,
so basically,
I know people
said that they were contemplating a return to the gold standard, making the dollar redeemable in gold at close to its current price. They hadn't worked out the details.
Well, we couldn't make the dollar redeemable in gold at the current price of gold. I mean, if the U.S. was to return to a redeemability, the gold price would have to go much, much higher. There's no way you can do it at the current price of gold. The dollar's not that valuable. We've printed way too much, so the gold would have to be thousands of dollars an ounce in order to do that. But we should do it. I mean, there's no question that we should do it. But
well,
if we don't
would,
do it, somebody
why
else.
Why would gold have to go so high?
Because we don't have enough. We don't have enough gold. If we're going to say we're going to make all the dollars redeemable in gold, where you can actually take your dollars to the Treasury or the Federal Reserve and they're going to give you gold, gotten Fort Knox, then you're going to have to make a ratio where we have enough gold to back the dollars. And I don't think we have enough gold at $900 an ounce. I don't think it's even close.
Were you talking about a one-to-one ratio?
Or we could devalue the dollar. That's what we do. We'd say the dollar, I mean, officially the dollar is worth now 42. We'd have to have a huge devaluation to do it. So the question is, you know, how much gold would you get for $1? Anyway, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Also, before I forget, as far as media appearances, I was on, I guess we'll have it up on the website, I was on Fox and Friends this morning, 7 a.m. Eastern Time. I was on with Amity Shales, who wrote the book The Forgotten Man. First time I've met her in person. I recommend her book. It's on my website. So I did that. I also was on Lou Dobbs on CNN last night. And what do I got coming up? I taped a very good interview with ABC News, which will be aired. And they tell me they're going to use most of it. We did a lot of footage. A lot of times, you know, I do the major networks and they slice it up. But ABC News, I think Sunday morning, one of those morning shows, Good Morning America, whatever, on ABC, they're going to run it Sunday morning, and then they said they're going to repeat it again Sunday night, and I think it's also going to be on the ABC News website. So I recorded that. There is a chance that I will be on the CBS Evening News tomorrow. Oh, let me find out. They're going to let me know. But the producer would like to go with you tomorrow morning. Okay, great. So I will be on CBS nightly news tomorrow. I've got to go tape it in the city, so I got to work that. I just got that email in on my BlackBerry. So that's good. I'm picking up, you know, more media appearances. At least I got a little appearance on Fox. Who knows? Maybe one of these days I'll finally get back on Glenn Beck. I'd like to start doing his show. As you know, I used to do the Glenn Beck show two, three times a week when he was on CNN. I've yet to do it on Fox. Although, again, I was on his inaugural show. They did have me scheduled in for that. The very first show, they, you know, really went out of their way to book me. And then last minute, they canceled me and haven't booked me since. But at least I got on Fox and Friends, which was good. I'm trying to think if I have anything else coming up. But if you check my website, again, check the Europac website. I make reference to my upcoming appearances, and you can keep track. Because usually I don't even know till last minute. And I don't have a chance, you know, I don't send any emails out, really. I just put it up on the website. You know, I'm doing a lot more public speaking. It's kind of amazing. I turned down most of the requests. But tomorrow I'm doing a webinar, I guess, with Google for the employees on Google on their in-house system. And I'm speaking, I think, at Columbia University on Friday. And I've got a lot of stuff on my schedule, a lot of speaking requests coming in. From around the world, and I try to keep people appraised of my speaking engagements also on my website, at least the ones that people can attend that are open to the public. We just had another good event down in Florida in Boca Raton. I think we had about 400 people that showed up at a small university in Boca Raton. We had all the brokers down there from the West Palm Beach office. John Brown was there. So maybe some people are calling in. We're there. I'm going to try to do more of these events as I travel and as I have time to book them. Anyway, let me go back to the phones. Mark in Oregon.
Hi, Peter. Can you hear me?
Loud and clear, Mark.
Okay. I wanted to get your opinion on a couple of things. I am actually investing kind of heavily in leveraged bear fund ETFs, actually some short-term trading there, especially at the top of this, most recent rally. I wanted to get your opinion on some of those, investments, what you think about them. And then the other question that I had was that if there was to be a collapse of the dollar, which I see clearly, and I'm in 100% agreement with you, what would you expect that the market, the Dow Jones average, for example, the stock market, what do you think that would actually happen? Do you think that the market, would there be a massive panic and that the market would go down? Or do you think that it would be followed by, a tremendous upsurge because, there'd kind of be possibly some instant inflation or something like that.
Yeah.
It's kind of hard for me to figure out what's going on.
Yeah, I don't know. It really depends on the sequence of events and when and how things unfold. My gut is that the market hasn't seen the lows nominally. I still think we're going to go down and make new lows for the Dow, but maybe we won't. I mean, maybe we'll be surprised, and maybe the low is in. I kind of doubt it. But in real terms, we're nowhere near the low. In terms of the gold price of the Dow, gold got to about 7.8 ounces of gold. I think maybe the Dow is now worth 8.5 or something like that. But I still think we're going to go below 2-1 and get close to 1-1. And in terms of other currencies, the Dow is going to go down. But at some point, if the dollar really starts to decline, U.S. stocks are going to rise, just like in Zimbabwe. The Zimbabwe stock market is probably the best-performing stock market in the world if you measure it in Zimbabwe dollars. I mean, it's percentage-wise, it's up dramatically every year, but it's not going up in real terms. And so as the dollar starts to free fall, Yeah, Americans are going to do whatever they can to get rid of their dollars. They'll buy U.S. stocks. They'll buy U.S. real estate. You know, they don't. They'll buy anything that isn't the dollar. You know, as I said, when the market was dropping, right, it was a rush to get out of stuff and in dollars. People were worried about stuff losing value, and they wanted dollars to preserve their wealth. Well, once people perceive that the risk is in the dollar, that the dollar is the riskiest asset, then people are going to look to get rid of their dollars and get stuff. And then the prices for stuff is going to go straight up because no one's going to want to sell their stuff. Right now, people wanted to sell their stuff because they were afraid. They wanted dollars. But when they're afraid of the dollar, no one's going to want to sell stuff for dollars. And so prices will go straight up. And I think ultimately, you're going to see a form of a crash up in asset prices when expressed in U.S. dollars. It doesn't mean that the holders of those assets are going to be intrinsically wealthier. They're not. They're just going to have to own them because the alternative is to go broke.
Okay, so basically, if you were to hold these instruments, as I am right now, I mean, it's actually somewhat of a risk if there was a rapid decline in the dollar because...
I mean, if you're short. Yeah, I mean, from a long-term perspective, and I went over this in Crash Proof, you can make money on the short side in the short run as a speculator. But as a long-term strategy, if you're short the overall market, if somebody just, you know, if you're Rip Van Winkle and you short the U.S. market, you know, and you come back in 5 or 10 years, you could lose a lot of wealth that way. If you short a stock that goes bankrupt, fine. But if you short the whole market, it's not going to go to zero. So as a long-term strategy, you don't want to be short stocks. You want to be short the dollar. And so when you're short stocks, it's the opposite of that. So in the short run, as a speculator, you can be short as long as you know when to cover. But from a long-term investment strategy, just being short and holding short is not going to work. You need to be long, and you need to be long things that pay dividends or real assets.
No, I agree.
All right, well, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Okay, up next is Jeff in Ohio.
Yeah, Peter?
Hey, Jeff.
Yes, hey, how are you doing? Hey, I got a comment and then a couple questions. I thought it was pretty funny on Morning Joe last week when they showed all those clips. They were all from Fox, but they didn't show any. They didn't show any CNBC clips.
Well, Morning Joe is MSNBC, so they might as well take a jab at the other guy. You know, that's right. Why I think that's why I think Fox should have me on more and then show clips of CNBC. You know,
yeah, that would be great.
Because there's plenty of those. You know, there's some really funny ones with me and Mark Haynes. You know, and there's one on that somebody put a Peter Schiff was right video CNBC version where they have it's funny now to watch it because there was a debate with me and Diana Swonk, and she's trying to say, you know, why we're so productive and how great the economy is. And her argument is, she says to me, have you been to Detroit? Have you been inside an auto plant? I mean, she's using Detroit, our automobile, as an example of how competitive and how productive we are. And of course, it's much funnier now that these companies are in bankruptcy.
Right. Hey, I think what you're doing is great. And I remember hating economics in high school and college, and now I'm gotten an interest again. But my main question was, there was a blogger, I don't know if you want me to name his name, but he had written a couple weeks ago a column called, or a piece called Hyperinflation is Impossible. And in one of his premises, he says he doesn't have a business or an economics background, but he's a student of the Austrian School of Economics. But he says the vast majority of our money supply is in the form of electronic credit, and electronic credit can be destroyed, while physical notes issued by a central bank cannot. This is why deflation is possible in a credit-based monetary system, but not in a paper-based monetary system. So how would you respond to something like that?
It doesn't even make sense. To say that is basically what you're saying is then we can print as much money as we want, and we don't have to worry about it losing its value. That's absurd. If that was really the case, so nobody has to work, nobody has to do anything, we just print money and we're all going to be rich? I mean, what if the government just printed up $1 million and mailed it to everybody? We wouldn't have massive inflation. I mean, how can that be?
Well,
part
of it is he says that it's 10% of our money is paper money, and then the rest is credit.
Yeah, it's, look, just because it doesn't exist in the form of a banknote, an actual physical piece of paper, it's still money supply. It's still created. You know, the way money comes into existence now, it's not all printed. It's electronic. With the way the Federal Reserve creates money, right? Let's say the Federal Reserve wants to buy a government bond. The way it does it is it credits the government's bank account with dollars. So let's say the government wants the Federal Reserve buy $1 billion worth of government bonds and expand the money supply. It doesn't print $1 billion. It just credits the federal government's bank account at the Federal Reserve with $1 billion. Now the federal government writes checks. It writes Social Security checks, welfare checks, you know, whatever it's doing. And now the people get those checks and deposit them in their banks. And so the money is never in bill form. It's in electronic form. But just because it exists in cyberspace doesn't mean that we can't have hyperinflation. In fact, we can probably have it even quicker because we can get the money out there even quicker.
So you're basically saying it's all bunk with those guys' position.
Yeah, exactly.
And then I missed you got any time for another question?
Well, quick, because I got a guy hanging on from Germany. I wanted to take his call, but go ahead.
Okay. I missed a little bit of the top of the show, but I know you were talking about China. But I had seen when you were talking down in Alabama, you said the Chinese, they know they're not going to get their money back. So if that is true, why in the hell would they even invest one more dollar in America? I don't get it.
Well, look, they're probably trying to maintain the illusion. They know, look, if the Chinese actually came out and said, we know the dollar is going to crash. We know it's worthless. It would happen. So maybe what they have to do is they have to posture while they're spending their dollars. I mean, what their strategy is, let's talk up the dollar. Let's say we'll never back away from the dollar. We're always going to have the dollar. Meanwhile, they're trying to find ways to get rid of them. They're trying to buy other assets with the dollar. Because if the Chinese advertise that they want it out, the bottom would drop out of the market. So what the Chinese have to do is talk the opposite. You know, it's like a pump and dump. They've got to pump up the dollar so they can dump it. I mean, I'm sure that's their strategy.
All right. Okay. Well, that
thanks
makes
for
sense.
The call. Yeah.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. All right. Let me quickly take an international call from Germany. It's Christopher. Go ahead.
Hey, Peter. Thanks for taking my call. I've got two questions. My first question is on China. It seems like you're pretty big on China in at least indirect investments. My question on that is, on the one hand, you're big on China, but China is still pretty socialist in that 50% of the company assets are state-owned, and all the land is state-owned. On the other hand, you're very critical about the U.S. moving towards socialism. So I was wondering how you resolve that.
It's an interesting point. And the solution is China is moving away from socialism and we're moving towards it. And so when you start from a socialist or communist model, they are gradually privatizing. They are gradually giving their citizens more property rights, more economic freedom. We're taking those rights away. We're moving from a market-based economy to a socialist economy. I think we might have already passed, we've got past the midpoint, but we're not completely communist yet or socialist, and they're not completely free. But they're moving in the right direction. And when you're investing, you have to look at a trend. You have to invest for the future. So I'm looking at what's happening in China and extrapolating into the future. I'm doing the same thing with America. I don't like what I see happening in America. I don't like the change that I'm seeing, but I like the change that I'm seeing in China. But would I prefer it if China was the way America used to be? Yeah, but they're not there yet. We'll see how far they go.
Okay, great. And my second question was on gold. You just got a question about that. And I was looking at the numbers, and I guess if the price of gold went up to 3,000, I guess we could have redeemability on just the 800 billion notes in circulation. Does it make a big difference having the non-redeemability?
I think it's better if it's redeemable because that's what keeps you honest. See, the reason that we had to leave the gold standard in 1971 was that you know, Europeans tried to redeem their dollars for gold because they didn't believe us. They knew that we were printing too many. So you, it really is important that the currency be redeemable in quantities of gold to keep the central banks honest. Because if it's like writing checks that no one can cash, well, if you know no one's going to cash them, you can write a lot of checks. It's the fact that you know whenever you write a check that it's going to go to your bank, that you make sure that the check is going to clear, that there's enough money in there. So that's what you have to make sure. I mean, it needs to be redeemable. That's a key, I think.
All right. Anyway, thanks a lot.
Thank you very much for staying up late and listening. Also, before I take the next caller, I wanted to mention one of the last callers talked about, you know, the fact that he was learning economics now, and it was a lot more enjoyable and entertaining, you know, learning it from me. And, you know, I get that a lot. I mean, I give my seminars, and, you know, a lot of people, you know, there's a lot of laughter in my seminars. And a lot of it is because, I mean, the things that are happening are so ridiculous. When you look at them from a common sense point of view, we can see the humor in all this. And the interesting thing is I'm delivering my message, you know, which is there's a lot of bad news out there, but at least I'm delivering in a way that's entertaining and people get a laugh, but they learn something. And, you know, the message is getting out there. I mean, I get emails every day from college kids and high school kids, not only in America, but all around the world, who are reading my stuff, who have read my books. I mean, these obviously, they're not investors, right? I mean, so I'm reaching an audience that goes way beyond the investors that I, you know, specifically try to target, because, you know, I run a brokerage firm, Euro Pacific Capital, and obviously I'm trying to get clients. I'm trying to reach out to investors to help them protect their wealth, to get them into foreign assets, to get them out of the dollar, to get them into precious metals. But at the same time, I'm attracting an even greater audience of young people who aren't even real prospects for my brokerage firm, but they're learning. And I'm helping to shape their minds, and I think it's very important that I'm influencing a lot of young people. And what I think is amazing about it is that, you know, in the past, the young people were drawn to socialism because, you know, the old saying was, if you're not a socialist by the time you're 22, you don't have a head. If you're not a conservative by the time you're 28, you don't have a brain. Or if you're not a socialist by the time you're 22, you don't have a heart. And if you're not a conservative, you don't have a brain. But now a lot of young kids are embracing the Austrian School of Economics because they heard me or they read my book. They're embracing free market capitalism, and they're shunning the socialist ideas of the left. And I think this is a very positive thing for being optimistic about the future of the United States. And you can also see that in, you know, the number of young people who supported Ron Paul. And so that's certainly a reason to be optimistic about the future, knowing that there are these type of young people in this country who are thinking this clearly at such a young age. Anyway, let me go to Scott in New York.
Hey, Pete, one question. With respect to exchanging dollars for a foreign currency, guard against the prospect of hyperinflation, would you comment, please, on the usefulness or lack thereof of the Canadian dollar to do that?
I like the Canadian dollar. You know, I used to call it the Canadian peso years and years ago, but I like it. I think the Canadians got their act together. They're in much better shape than the U.S. And I think they're in position to, you know, trade with the Chinese and trade with the rest of the world. And even though they are in a very close proximity to the United States, and so by that token, they're going to be hit a little bit harder than other countries. I still think it makes sense to be invested in Canada. I think there's a lot of resources in Canada, and I think a lot of Americans are going to move to Canada. I think, you know, it's probably one of the countries that is going to be the easiest to emigrate to, and I think that they will have the benefit of some very hardworking, bright Americans who are looking to flee, you know, the inflation and the high taxes and the high regulations of the U.S. economy, looking for opportunities someplace else. I mean, it's attached. You know, so you don't have to, you know, you can visit your family members. It's the same language. So I think I'm optimistic about Canada.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Okay. Yeah, I would be surprised if, you know, some of the northern states, you know, actually want to join, leave the United States and join up with Canada or maybe go independent. I mean, you know, we joke about that. I mean, things could get so bad in this country. I could see certain states, Alaska, maybe Texas, wanting to secede from the Union, wanting to get out of this mess. And, of course, you know, the U.S. government's not going to let that happen. I mean, we already know what happened when the South tried to secede. We had a civil war. I'm sure that there's no way. Even if the people of Texas voted out of the Union, I don't think Washington, D.C. would sit back and let them leave, because that would open up the floodgates. If they let one state go, believe me, a lot of states would want out of this deal. I mean, the states that would want to leave the Union first are the states that pay more taxes to the federal government than they get in benefits from the federal government. They're obviously a net loser. You know, the states that are the recipient of a lot of government money, where they get more money from the government than they pay in taxes, they're the ones that would want to stay. But as you know, if states started to leave, you know, the states paying the taxes started to leave, then that would put more pressure on the states that remained, and everybody would want out. But who knows? I mean, who knows what's going to happen as a result of this? You know, everybody is focusing on the European Union. Oh, is the European Union going to break up? Is it going to fall apart? What about the United States? No one talks about the fact that the United States could break up or fall apart. But you know what? Things are going to get very difficult based on what the government is doing. Times are going to get very tough for a lot of people. And who knows? Who knows what's going to happen? Anyway, next up is Mike in Ohio. Mike, you there?
Yeah, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Loud and clear.
Okay, great. Hey, my question was, are there any benefits to the dollar going down and the United States gold reserves?
Well, look, ultimately, the dollar has to go down. I mean, it's not a good thing that our currency has to fall in value. Given how uncompetitive we are right now, given how many dollars we've already printed, given how many factories we've already shut down, given our lack of savings and lack of productivity, the dollar has to go down. It's just unavoidable. It's an unavoidable consequence of our profligacy. But that being said, once the dollar drops sharply, we have to put a floor under it. We have to stabilize the dollar at a lower level. We need sound money. Unfortunately, the dollar has to drop because of what we've already done. Because the only way we're going to get competitive again, even if we have lower regulation and lower taxes, we need lower wages at this point. And the only way we're going to get lower wages is with a lower dollar. We need lower wages globally. The reason that our wages got so high in the first place was because American workers had more capital behind them than foreign workers. That's what raises worker productivity. That's what enables somebody to have a high wage. It's because you give them capital. The reason somebody that is operating a bulldozer can earn more money than somebody operating with a shovel is because the guy got the bulldozer. He has the capital. And the problem is we don't have the capital anymore, and so wages are going to have to fall. They don't have to stay low. They can rise over time as we reindustrialize and recapitalize our workforce. But unfortunately, we're going to need a weaker dollar, and it's going to have a positive impact long term on our economy. But in the short run, obviously, it's going to be painful, because a weaker dollar means we buy less stuff, which means we have a lower standard of living. But again, that's the consequences of what we've already done. It's like, it's not good to get fat. If I say, well, you know, being fat isn't a good thing, but if I stuff my face with food, I'm fat. I can't help it. I mean, that's the consequences of my bad diet and my lack of exercise. Now, I don't have to stay fat. I can get on that treadmill. I can start eating salads. That's what America needs to do.
Okay, and so there is no, I know you said a long-term benefit, but immediately. So if the U.S. dollar is plunging, then ultimately the value of our gold reserves is going up, though, correct?
No, the value of our gold reserves is going up in dollars. Now, the question is, will the value of our gold reserves be going up in other currencies? Probably. But here's going to be the problem. Uh-huh. When the dollar plunges, right, and America, if we want to import oil, if we want to import other goods, we're going to have to pay for them with gold. I mean, the reason that we accumulated our gold reserves is because we exported so much stuff. We earned all that gold. And at this point, when the dollar collapses, we're in such a mess that we're going to have to spend a lot of that gold to survive. So even though we have a big gold reserve now, I mean, I'm assuming that we do, because I don't, you know, maybe the audits aren't true. But assuming we have the gold we claim we have, we're not going to be able to keep it, because we're going to have to spend it.
Right. And just one last question, if you could.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about, and I've looked for this information, and perhaps I haven't looked hard enough, but the private court or the private banks that hold shares in the Federal Reserve. I mean, do you know who they are or how that or how that operates?
No, I'm not really sure. I know the Federal Reserve is a private corporation. I'm not exactly sure the shareholders, and you know, it's a unique corporation in that it's allowed to earn a certain profit based on its assets, and then everything beyond that, I think it's a 5% return on assets. Anything beyond that is paid as a tax to the U.S. government, 100% tax. That's the reason that the Federal Reserve has the most expensive building in Washington, because they have no incentive, because whatever they don't spend, they have to give back to the government. So it's very inefficient. They'll overpay for things. It's a big conflict of interest. But I'm not actually sure, you know, who these shareholders are or what the I forget what the banks are. But I know it's private, but it doesn't function like a private company. It obviously functions as if it were a government agency, but it's not. I mean, if you get a letter from the Federal Reserve, it's got a stamp on it, right? It's not frank. If you get a letter from a government agency, if you get a letter from the IRS, you get a letter from Congress, there's no stamp on it. They run it. It's frank by the post office. But if you get a letter from the Federal Reserve, if Ben Bernanke sends you a letter, there's a postage stamp on it. The reason there's a postage stamp is because the Fed is private. It's not part of the government. But it acts like it is. I mean, now, you know, every time you see, you know, I mean, Ben Bernanke is sitting right next to Geithner, right next to – they're all one big happy family, all, you know, all peas in a pod. And the Fed is not doing its job. The Fed is supposed to be independent. And the reason it was a private corporation is because the Fed was giving powers to do things that the government can't do. The government's not – there's nothing in the Constitution that lets the government print money. You know, there's nothing that lets them issue, you know, notes like the Fed's doing. But anyway, the whole concept obviously didn't work because the Federal Reserve acts as if it was a branch of the government. And just about every American citizen thinks it's part of the government.
Thank you very much.
Sure. Thanks for your call. Okay, next up, Brian in Connecticut. Go ahead, Brian. And hold before Brian goes, I got two more callers on hold, about 15 minutes left to go. So let's take no more new calls. I'll just work with the ones I got on the board. Go ahead, Brian.
Hey, Peter. I just want to let you know I just bought your book, Crash Proof, and just recently got my college degree, MBA, everything. And I'm a new investor. I saw you on Kudlow. I'd like if you would maybe, you know, I'm not a making a lot of money right now to be a current client of the Euro Pacifica, but I love the website and I just really got onto you in the last couple of weeks. Was wondering for like a first time investor, just reading your book, just kind of getting my toes wet. You know, obviously I'll read the book. I view the website. I listen to you the last couple of weeks on Wednesdays. I love it, but I was just wondering if you could maybe give me some financial planning. I don't want to ask for advice, but kind of where,
well, I don't know. I mean, Call up the firm, speak to a broker. I don't know if you don't have that much money to invest, you might want to just start by buying gold coins or silver coins. You know, can't go wrong there. How did you first hear about me? Was it on the Kudlow show?
On Kudlow, yeah.
Oh, great. Yeah, I haven't done that show this week. I don't know. I didn't think I did it last week, but we'll see. I had started doing it every week for a while, so. But I should be back on that program soon. Hopefully they'll get me back on that MSNBC I did with Morning Joe. That was a good interview. I mean, it's up on YouTube and it's on my website. But
yep.
I had a good interview, so maybe I'll be able to do that show more often. That was the first time I've been on MSNBC. So.
And I heard about you said about gold. I've been really trying to read about as much as I can. And I know you said about the gold companies maybe performing a little bit better than the currency. So would you say like in terms of where you see things going with the gold price, if you wouldn't mind just maybe commenting real quick, thank you.
I think gold prices are going higher. And I said I think the fact that gold stocks are breaking out, leading the price of gold, could be a bullish sign. We'll see. It could be a positive divergence. And yeah, young guy yourself, I mean, I got a lot of my own money in gold stocks, but if I was in my 20s, that might be all the stocks I would own. I would own nothing but gold stocks.
Yeah,
anyway,
I thank you for your time.
Sure. Thanks a lot, Brian. Next call at John in California.
Yeah. Hey, Peter. How you doing? Thanks for taking
my
call.
Sure.
Just a quick question. You know, I've been trading. I trade futures, S&P futures primarily, and have been for 12, 15 years now. Generally, I'll park all of my excess cash and T-bills and earn a little bit of interest and use that as a collateral for the trades that I do with my brokerage firm. Given your views on the dollar and on U.S. debt and things, is there a better currency to hold that collateral in that I could, purchase through my firm?
I mean, what
you know,
collateral?
instead of holding, you know, if I've got a, you know, X amount of dollars in my account, you know, I'll purchase T-bills and then I use that to trade the futures against those T-bills. It's collateral.
Yeah,
to trade
I understand. Now I understand what you're saying. The question is though, your brokerage firm may not let you use other currency as collateral. They may require the collateral be in the form of dollars.
If I could use another currency, is there a particular?
I mean, I don't know, the Japanese yen, the Swiss franc. I mean, there are other currencies you can use. And, of course, you can always hedge. So if you've got a commodities account, I mean, you can hedge yourself. So if you buy one futures contract, for a small margin, and you can hedge all the dollars that are long in your account that you're using, to act as margin money. So, you know, in a way, you know, if you have, $100,000 in your account, and you end up buying one futures contract, I mean, that covers the whole – it hedges the whole thing.
Okay.
You follow me?
Yeah, I do. So I'm just looking at this in light of your view on the dollar, you know, dropping. Is there a better place to put my dollars that are sitting in my brokerage account right now?
To the extent that your brokerage firm – can do Forex trades for you, sure.
Yeah,
and it's better to hold other currencies. You can hold Japanese yen, you can hold euros, you can hold Swiss francs. I mean, there are a number of currencies that you can own.
Do you see, in the event of the dollar collapsing here, do you see those other currencies, you know, rising in result of the collapse or?
Yeah, well, when the dollar is collapsing, generally we're talking about its exchange rate versus other currencies. So as the dollar is going down, other currencies are rising. That's going to happen. Now, I also think that all currencies are going to lose value, so that gold, I believe, will go up in terms of all currencies. But I think you'll see a bigger rise in the dollar price of gold than you will for the yen price of gold or the euro price of gold, because the dollar is going to be losing ground faster than these other currencies.
Okay, great. Thanks for your time.
Thanks for the call. The last caller of the evening, Chris in New York.
Hey, Mr. Schiff.
Hey, Chris, you're on the air.
Hey, how you doing? I'm 16, and I love everything you do. I mean, I watch your YouTube videos. Like, I love everything about it. But I was debating with my dad whether overregulation or underregulation caused the problems that we have today. I was kind of wondering, like, you know.
Well, you know my answer, right?
No, not really. I want to get like an in-depth, like I don't really understand it, you know. Can you explain it?
Well, I mean, read my writings and read my books, but in a nutshell, it was excess regulation, interference in the free market. The government interfered in such ways that the natural restraints and mechanisms, market mechanisms, that would have prevented a lot of these things from happening, happened. You know, when they talk about the fact that we had all these greedy people on Wall Street doing all these crazy things, we've always had greedy people on Wall Street. The whole country is full of greedy people. We all want things. We're all greedy. But what keeps us in check is that we don't want to lose. We're fearful. I mean, when you walk into a casino, why don't you just gamble all your money? I mean, obviously you could win a fortune. Well, the reason you don't do it is because you could also lose, and you know that you probably will. So you're cautious about how you gamble. But if you walk into a casino with somebody else's money, hell, why not take a shot? And that's what the Fed enabled everybody to do. By giving out all this cheap money, by making gambling riskless, by providing the Greenspan put, too big to fail, by creating this sense of complacency that the government wouldn't let anybody go broke and the government can fix every problem with a printing press, we created these moral hazards. Now, a lot of things were done that shouldn't have been done. As I said, you know, when President Bush said Wall Street got drunk, he was right. Wall Street was drunk. But he forgot to mention that the government poured all the alcohol. And, you know, so when you get everybody drunk, they do stupid things. They do things that they wouldn't have done sober. And that's what happened, you know, on Wall Street. That's what happened all over the world. And the government, you know, if it wasn't for the Fannie and Freddie, I mean, if they didn't exist, if they didn't have that government guarantee, then we never would have had this gigantic real estate bubble. They were there providing the air. Why was it that Americans were able to borrow so much money? because they had the government co-signing all the debts. You know, it, normally in the free market, Americans wouldn't be able to borrow this much money because the lenders would be worried about getting their money back. But the minute the government interferes and says, don't worry, we'll give you the money back, then it's all right, fine, we'll loan. And so there is all these problems. But, of course, the big casualty in this is that the free market has taken the blame for problems created by government. And now the solutions are more government, which means we're going to get even bigger problems. This is exactly what happened with Roosevelt in the 1930s. Hoover came in with his big government policies and created the Depression, got it started. Then Roosevelt came in and said, we had a Depression because Hoover was a capitalist and there was too much free markets, which was completely false. And then his solution was the New Deal, and that extended the Depression, and now we're still living with the consequences of the New Deal.
Can I ask you a question about that also? When did the Great Depression end? Like, my teachers tell me that it ended, like, directly before World War II. Did it end before or after? Because I heard you say that it ended after World War II, and I didn't really understand that. Like, can you
Well, I don't know when the official end was, it, if it was during the war. I mean, obviously, you know, when the war erupted, you know, the economy changed. But the lifestyles, the standards of living within the country probably went down during the war. You had women going into the workforce, and their husbands were off fighting a war, and we had rationing. People couldn't get things because all the resources were being used for the war effort, and everybody was buying bonds, whatever money that you had. You know, the government was going around with these bond, war bonds, selling war bonds. I mean, we financed World War II without borrowing any money from abroad. We financed it ourselves. We sacrificed. You know, when we started the war on terror, you know, what did the U.S. government do? The U.S. government didn't tell Americans to buy bonds to save their money to fight the war. Bush said, go out and buy new cars. Just like Obama is saying now, go out and buy cars. We'll pass the hat to the Chinese. We'll make them pay for this nonsense. I don't know when it officially ended, but I think the Second World War didn't help get us out of the Depression. No more than the New Deal helped get us out of the Depression. The reality is, despite the New Deal, and despite World War II, the free market got us out of the Depression, which never would have existed without the government. The reason it took the free market so long is because of all the barriers and roadblocks the government kept putting in its way, and all the interference. And that's exactly what they're doing today.
Can I ask one more question, just real quick?
Quickly, we're running out of time.
Real quick. Did you hear about Obama telling the owner of GM or the CEO of GM to, you know, get to get fired? Like, he had to leave. Do you know about that?
Well, I think the government had some influence over that. But look, we were already down the slippery slope. I mean, according to the government, two wrongs make a right. The government has no business dictating salaries in private corporations or who should run them or who should be fired or who should be hired. But the problem is, we had no business bailing them out. So once we gave them federal money, we corrupted the whole process. And now that the government is putting money into these companies, the government is claiming control. The government is saying, you've taken taxpayer money. Now we get to determine how you're paid or how you use that money. I don't think so. Once the government gives these companies the money, it's their money, and it's none of the government's business. Now, the government should have put the restriction on the money before they gave it to them and before it was accepted. But the whole process was poisoned from the beginning because there should be no bailouts. There should be no outrage over AIG because they shouldn't have got the money. I mean, here you have the government giving AIG billions, and now they're complaining about the way they're using the money. Well, why did they give it to them? The whole thing is nuts. Anyway, we're running out of time. Thanks for the call. I love it that a 16-year-old is reading my stuff, and I hope there's more out there like you. Anyway, I know we're starting to run out of time, down about 40 seconds or so. Thanks, everybody. I will be back again next week with another live episode of Wall Street Unspun. Keep looking for the video blogs. I know I'm going to get some better equipment soon and make those things better. Remember to read Crash Proof. Still working on Crash Proof 2.0. I'm up to Chapter 8, so I'm mostly finished there. Again, don't forget to call 800-727-7922 to talk to a Euro-Pacific Capital broker to get your account open and get your dollars here before it's too late and they lose their value. Anyway, it's 800-727-7922. Thanks again, everybody, for listening. I'll be back next week. So long.